Good afternoon. My name is Savannah, and I am the producer of the Roxborough House Roundtables at Jefferson East Falls. Each episode is recorded and later posted on our YouTube channel for those who are not able to make it to the live event. They are also aired on the first and third Sundays of each month from 8 to 9 a.m. on G-Town Radio 92.5 FM WGGT. For today's roundtable, we're talking about Asian Americans in law. Our host, Kavi, who is a first-year law and society major, will be discussing the several stereotypes revolving around Asian Americans, including the legal professions.
Hello, I'm Kavi. So first I'm going to outline what exactly the model minority myth is for those who don't know. So the model minority myth is a set of stereotypes meant to categorize Asian people. So you've probably actually heard a lot of these stereotypes circulating in our culture before. So some of them include that Asian people are competent but tend to be kind of cold and robotic, and that they don't really have time for fun because they're so focused on being productive, due in large part to a quote-unquote immigrant mentality that's been ingrained into them, which is rooted in hustle culture from their supposed immigrant parents. And another stereotype associated with Asian people from this myth is that they're interchangeable because of their said robotic nature, and they're antisocial beings who are always at their desk doing work. But a lot of the myths that are associated with Asian people are kind of weaponized and masked as compliments. So because they're so smart, they don't even require assistance at all because they're so studious and self-sufficient. And the model part is included because Asians are seen as the model for how other marginalized groups should be acting. They've faced oppression, and that's recognized, but they've worked so hard that they've achieved such a high level of success that they represent high-earning jobs, particularly in STEM careers. Again, they can crank out large amounts of work, but they fail to make a genuine impact in society a lot of the time. Again, they don't need help because they are the model's minority and they already know everything, and more focus should be on other marginalized groups.
Probably, if I just interrupt you, though, because we have to have definitions. What is Asian? I've seen that being confused because you're defining it. What is really defined as Asian people?
Right, that is a good question. So Asia is a very large continent. And there's this very big idea in society that when we're talking about Asian people, we're only talking about East Asian people. And then even more specific than that, we're only really talking about, you know, Chinese, Japanese, and Korean people. And that's just a really gross overgeneralization of a non-monolithic group of people, because the entire continent of Asia expands across so many different groups. I myself am South Asian, specifically Bangladeshi, and I've been categorically excluded from multiple conversations surrounding the Asian community because people don't even socialize me as Asian, which is really not only kind of hurtful, but also like brings up a lot of confusion in conversations when I say I'm Asian and people are like, no, you're Indian. And it's like, one, India is in Asia. Two, I'm also just not Indian. So that really goes into this whole idea of the model minority myth, honestly, because if you really, you know, look into the statistics, because this myth is predicated on this sort of idea that Asian people make up a high proportion of like high earning STEM careers, but that, again, is only really this very particular like group of the larger category of Asian people. If we're talking about, you know, Cambodian, Burmese, or just like, you know, West Asian, Southeast Asian, other groups in those communities, their average median household income is about like half as much, you know, around the more so like the $45,000 a year threshold. And nobody really talks about them. They're entirely excluded from the conversation because of the limiting nature of the model minority myth.
Kavi, why do you think that's done? Why do you think Asians are compartmentalized, first of all, between those in East Asia as opposed to South Asia? That's the first thing. What is behind that? And secondly, as far as your personal experiences, how have you felt put in a certain box where you may not think you belong, or people have expectations of you that aren't correct?
My gut reaction is to say a lot of it is rooted in colorism. East Asian, not all East Asian people, but a lot of them tend to be lighter in complexion than the majority of South Asian people, for example. So I think it's easier for them to kind of, you know, matriculate into white America without as many eyes bat at them. There's still obviously like, you know, difficulties they experience, but it is much harder in general for somebody with darker skin to kind of assimilate into white America. And as for how I've had experiences with this sort of distinction as a South Asian person. I did mention earlier that I'm often excluded from conversations about Asian people, which is why I really wanted to host this roundtable in the first place, to kind of, I guess, take ownership over the fact that I am Asian and we, like, non-East Asians exist. But also specifically, there were, at my high school and even at Jefferson to a certain extent, there are a lot of, or at least, like, there are a few, groups that, groups as in clubs, and organizations that are, have Asian in their title. Like, my high school had the Asian Pacific Pacific Islander Union. But then I would, like, go into these spaces, and they were just so predominantly East Asian. And, like, it's not like there weren't other South Asians at my school, but there was this kind of idea that was within our culture that we didn't fit in because we were inherently different. So we had our own club called, you know, Indian Pakistani Cultural Organization, which, not that I think it's unnecessary to have a separate club for it, but if a whole other club is predicated on this idea that it's bringing together all Asian people, but they're still not going out of their way to make it clear that non-East Asian people are still Asian, then how are we supposed to feel comfortable entering the same space? So yeah, that's what I would say in regards to that. But I do think that these myths tied to the model minority myth and the sort of societal distinctions within different Asian groups are very prevalent. So out of curiosity, I actually sent out a survey. 10, you know, college students, varied racial identities and majors, from anywhere from like entomological sciences to psychology to media studies and production, only because I wanted to kind of get both a STEM perspective and a humanities perspective, because I kind of have an inherent bias being a humanities person. So of the 10 people surveyed, exactly 5 knew what the model minority myth is, 4 said no, and 1 said maybe. which really goes to show that despite these ideas being so widespread, we don't even know the language of how to refer to it. And again, of the 10 people surveyed, 9 said that the first image that pops into their head when they think of a lawyer is a white man. And 9 said that when they first think of an Asian American, the first sort of professional industry that they associate with them is either STEM related or something high earning in the business sector, which very much drives my point home about all of the ways in which Asian people are socialized. And I specifically included the question about what's the first image that pops into your head when you think of a lawyer, because it, and like I said, 9 said white man. So it's representative of both the gender and racial dynamics within the legal profession, and how a sort of masculine dominance is seen as necessary to take on a position seen as dominant as being a lawyer is, and that only like kind of white men are seen as being able to do the job because Asians are too awkward and they don't have they might have you know, hard skills like raw knowledge, but they don't have the soft skills that will allow them to be good communicators. And again, a lot of the other things that I mentioned earlier.
That lack of emotionality that you pointed out, mm-hmm. or the stereotype of automaton, or yes. what you just stated, why do you think that exists, and how does that stereotype impact on you or your friends or family?
I think that stereotype exists because, at least for as far as law is concerned, it is in its nature a very serious profession, because a lot of the times it is, you know, people's lives on the line, people's basic human rights on the line. And so you kind of need to be like a machine in that sense. Because if you are too emotional, it might, you know, impact your how you communicate in a court setting where you're expected to be very controlled and very articulate. You know, Asian people are generally seen as like, they're almost seen as an automaton in their own ways, because what I said earlier about the immigrant mentality kind of has this association with it, where you distract yourself with work so that you don't need to focus on your emotions. But it's weaponized again against them in the sense that since they kind of work so hard and don't have like or show any emotions, then they can't sympathize with the victims, and that's kind of how they twist it, just to like put minority groups like Asian people down, because that same criticism isn't really levied against white people who are sort of robotic or like an automaton in nature. At least that's how I've found it as somebody with, like, you know, my mom, she is currently in law school. And she said, she also went to Penn, but she didn't go to Penn for law. She's in law school right now, but at a different school. But she said that she very consistently witnessed very cold white men, but they always got, you know, preferential treatment. Even her white student, who was always very rude to her when she was a TA, like, got promoted before her. And it's just systemically and societally made so that it's easier for white people who exhibit the same traits in a lot of instances as Asian people to get further ahead, just because of the way that we're socialized. So, yeah, but I do think... Yeah,
I have a question. When a lot of immigrants came over, we're going back to the 20s and 30s,
yes.
Like when Italians, the Jews, and Irish came here. They lived in communities of their own people for many reasons. First, they felt safe living among themselves, and plus they shared culture. And until they felt comfortable in a country and reaching out, they stayed within their neighborhoods. That is very much the new wave of immigrants to the United States is more from Asian countries. And they tend to, just like the earlier immigrants, go into their own churches and their own, whether it's there's Korean churches I notice in my neighborhood or South Asian supported churches. But that's no different than the original wave of immigrants that came. And you go throughout history, the immigrants come here, go in their own neighborhoods, and then get comfortable and then move out and assimilate to some degree. And that was accepted as the way. Why isn't it being accepted now as it was back then?
Okay, I think a lot of it is how insecure white America is, because from this, wave of Asian people taking up more like higher paying positions as doctors, engineers, computer scientists, and whatnot, they kind of feel threatened that, you know, we're taking their jobs away, we're taking jobs from them. And so they feel a need to kind of retaliate, and they created this entire set of stereotypes around them to put them down in a social sense, so that they're completely discouraged. So that they're completely discouraged from even pursuing their careers. Like even the people who are Asian who do pursue STEM still feel a slight sense of insecurity. Because even though the model minority myth kind of promotes the fact that a lot of them are good at math and science, they feel like they don't have the right to be in this position because they're taking jobs away from white people. And then the effect is even worse on people like me who are Asian and want to pursue the humanities, because we're seen as entirely invalid because we're supposed to be good at STEM because we're Asian. And like the entire Asians are so good at math very quickly becomes Asians are only good at math. Asians are like can't even go into careers that aren't based in STEM, essentially. And like I think that's like a big thing about why like what you were saying about why immigration has like never changed, but people's attitude surrounding it is it's sort of changing in light of us creating more of a presence for ourselves over our years of standing here. I already mentioned that how Asians are so good at math kind of becomes twisted. Another thing that I wanted to kind of shed light on is this idea where even, you know, second and third generation Asian Americans who speak English as a first or even sole language really are, you know, presumed to be ESL speakers. Since they're presumably used to speaking in their native tongue, they're, you know, not good in English, so they can't communicate in settings like court, you know, law. But math and science, those concepts are the same in every country. So that's a really big reason as to why this is the narrative that is being pushed. It's like they're making up for their lack of, you know, English and like analytical abilities through words by being extra good at math and science, because that's all they're kind of built to be good at, because they're assumed to not be good at English. Yeah, and then also, like I said earlier, they're seen to be submissive and sloppy in their speech, so they aren't eloquent enough to be lawyers.
Copy. Have you been faced personally, or your friends been faced personally with this type of prejudice?
I don't really honestly have any friends who are Asian who want to pursue law like I do, but I do follow a lot of Asian law students and lawyers on TikTok, and they have all communicated very sort of similar points to what I'm making here about how they've constantly felt almost an imposter syndrome because they're made to feel like they don't belong in these like legal settings because of the like multiple layers of this myth that are levied against them. And some have even like communicated like switching, not that they actually went through with it, but this idea that maybe they should switch career paths to something that they should, that they would rather assimilate easier, have an easier time assimilating into, because you there's this concept called the invisible labor clause, which is when you enter not necessarily a workplace, but really any environment. It's the extra work that you kind of have to do to just fit in on top of, the actual like work that is the job. So the invisible labor clause, Asian people, say they have, they're bringing their lunch to work. They probably a lot of the times have to eat something they are not used to in their cultural diet. That's a part of the invisible labor clause that I've heard, that I read about actually. This South Asian woman who was a lawyer brought biryani or something to her workplace, and one of her white male associates said, "Oh, it's your food that's stinking up the kitchen," and she was like so hurt by that, and she even said that it brought back out like her old like inner vulnerable child, because you'd think that like another big thing about this kind of topic that I'm proposing here is that you'd think that legal practitioners would be the ones sort of, promoting basic human respect, really, but they're letting this culture slide within their workplace, and that honestly has implications on the people they serve, because if they're not capable of showing any sort of if they aren't capable of realizing other people's dignity, then they're more likely to not to kind of exhibit the same behaviors on their own clients, which is really concerning in my opinion. To go further even with this idea that Asian mental health is impacted by these stereotypes.
Let me ask you that, because if you're supposed to be the stereotype, because you're supposed to be unemotional, you're supposed to be technical, you're supposed to be a math, science whiz, whatever it should be, automaton, using the word you use, does that, when you do show normal human emotions, do you feel that people find it out of character, or do you feel that you repress what you normally would because people would be shocked or surprised by that you're not the stereotype?
I do think people are surprised. This doesn't have to do with law specifically, but any time that I have, not even just with mental health, but there's this really big association with Asian people playing the violin or some sort of orchestral instrument. If you don't play those instruments, which I never did, that you like, you kind of like more like chill sort of music like that, or you listen to your own like music in your own language. It literally as early as like, I think I was like 12 or 13, I was talking about Cardi B because she was really popular at the time. One of my classmates was like, you know what rap music is? And he was just so surprised that I even like knew who Cardi B was, knew what the genre, listened to the genre, just because I don't fit this this stereotype with like decades of history. Actually, from my research, I found another story I read up on was that a Chinese man who was a lawyer, he was told that he was, you know, just a diversity hire, and he was told that he's just the needed Charlie Chan. And so I looked up who Charlie Chan was. Like, at first I thought it was just like some like racist, like, I mean, it is racist, but like at first I thought it was just like some like, you know, made up thing for funsies or whatever. But I looked up Charlie Chan, and basically he was this very racist detective character, actually, from the 30s. And he was this incredibly racist caricature who spoke very broken English. The character was canonically Chinese, but he was never played by Chinese actors, which is problematic in and of itself. It was, this character was created by a white man, and apparently his intention was to kind of humanize Chinese people and paint them in a good light, because this character was like, he always like kind of got down to business, and he was like a respectable sort of detective character. It kind of still perpetuated, despite this same sort of reframing of these stereotypes into compliments, so to speak. Perpetuated still this assumption that, first of all, that specifically East Asian people are kind of like sly and like sleuthy and deceitful, and secondly, like that they're like kind of like no nonsense, but to the point where they're like automatons. And I found it really interesting that how the media really perpetuated this, because Charlie Chan was apparently a hugely popular character, had like 15 books or something crazy like that, and it's like people were just eating this up and taking it to be true, and it's just persisted about a century later. Now we're like not quite, but you know, almost a century later. I think that's just
Gabby,
really.
If you want your mind blown on a real horrible stereotype, there's a movie called Breakfast at Tiffany's,
mm-hmm.
and everyone seems to know. In Breakfast at Tiffany's, Mickey Rooney, who is a white character, plays a white actor.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell by the name. He played an Asian character that was so unbelievably offensive that I don't think they could even show it. It was such a stereotype, And the other, of course, more famous is that Boo from what's the show? Boo plays the
Homer Simpson,
right? Like it's incredibly offensive as well. And I want, in light of what you just said, what does the media have to do with what you've seen in perpetuating the stereotype that you've been putting out there?
I think the media plays a really big role in kind of portraying specifically like Asian people in the roles like associated with this myth. So, you know, Asian people grow up watching this content and it becomes this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy where it's like, oh, I guess that's my future. And then non-Asian people are like, you know, yeah, this is what they're meant to do. This is the place. And if they don't put themselves in it, I'm going to put them in it. Also specifically with Apu in The Simpsons, that one is actually pretty relevant to me because I watched this documentary. I honestly kind of forget what it was called, but it was on HBO Max, and it was about the problem with Apu in The Simpsons. And when I watched the documentary, I realized that, like, even though I had never watched an episode of The Simpsons in my life, so much of, like, the treatment of, like, South Asian people, specifically ones who work in, like, corner stores, is, like, very much reflective of what was being put out there from The Simpsons in, I guess, like, the early 2000s or whatever. I worked at Dunkin' Donuts for minimum wage, and all of my coworkers were most, like 90% of them were Bangladeshi, and they were immigrants. So I would often translate for them when they needed it. There were genuinely, like, customers who would be, like, rude to them and, like, make fun of their accents or their English, things like that. And it would just come, like, it would just stick out to me as super ungrateful, because we're serving you and you still feel the right to, like, be so offended if we ask you to, like, repeat something because we didn't understand you the first time. Or, like, they'll, not gonna lie, some customer complaints are definitely, like, warranted, but half of the time it would just be these, like, bizarre comments, even by coworkers. I worked at another Dunkin', and one of my non-Bangladeshi coworkers, basically, also worth mentioning that my manager was Bangladeshi at this one, and so this coworker was talking to me and my manager, and this was specifically about us being Muslim, because I was raised Muslim from a Bangladeshi family. And so she was she asked us this as, like, a genuine question. She was like, how do you feel knowing that your husband sleeps with, like, 20 other women? She has no idea about my manager's, like, she just said this out of nowhere. She has no idea about my manager's personal life. It's literally just this assumption that she genuinely believes and is asking about because of anti-Muslim rhetoric, that's, like, associated with, you know, Pakistani people, Bangladeshi people, people from predominantly Muslim countries. The myth has, like, definitely affected me at, like, a personal level, and it's definitely perpetuated by that goddamn Apu from The Simpsons.
I mean, it basically sounds like people never outgrew ignorance or being a bully from school. So, going back to the lunch thing, I've seen stories, and it was actually in a TV show before, that this little Asian kid went back to his family and was like, I want an American lunch because people made fun of my lunch. I want to be normal. So how do you think we could stop that stigma in school? How do you think we can teach kids to be more open?
That's a very good point. It does definitely start, you know, when we're young. And I think I actually, like, do know what you're talking about. I saw that too. But I would say that, like, I think, well, first of all, it doesn't even start at school. It starts at home. But I'm not a parent, so I can't speak to, like, I guess, give unwarranted parenting advice, but I do think it's very beneficial for parents to instill values of, like, at least, if not, if not acceptance, at least cultural relativism at, like, a bare minimum. Cultural relativism is this idea that, like, you may not understand or agree with something, such as, like, you're not a fan of this culture's food or something like that. But everything is relative. So, you know, it's not right for my culture, but that's your culture. Go ahead. Like, that kind of thing. And, like, you don't need to be, like, I don't know, a biryani connoisseur or whatever. We're not asking that of you. We're not asking you to, like, you know, have biryani for every meal. We're not doing any of that. We're just asking that you don't kind of give us dirty looks, say anything offensive about our food stinking up the kitchen, anything like that about us eating biryani. And I think that's a very level-headed and reasonable request, that when that sort of standard isn't set early on, it just keeps on hardening and hardening and hardening. And then when it forms adults who are so entirely resistant to accepting different cultures other than theirs, and it leads to this really nasty, toxic culture, even within workplaces, and again, even within legal settings that are supposed to be promoting the public good and you know, moral values and anti-racism in an ideal world, but they're actually perpetuating these things all because of this unresolved societal stigma.
Now, Cobb, if I can ask you, you talked about how these adults end up growing up with these mindsets. Have you faced it at a collegiate level? Like, or do you feel supported in your identity here, or, like, going into school? I know you're a first year, so.
Yeah, I don't have that much college experience to speak about collegiate level. But I would say, I think when I'm in QSU, and for me, it kind of feels like a little bit like, it's a little bit harder for me to kind of relate to certain other people there who maybe aren't, like, maybe their only minority identity is being queer, because intersectionality really just guides a lot of how you kind of perceive you and navigate the world. And like, there's this big thing with, like, if you're already, you know, if you're already Asian, then being queer is sort of like a double whammy, and you really don't wanna, set yourself back more in society. I definitely feel like it's not, like, an unsafe space. Like, I feel safe going there, but there is a sort of metaphorical grain of salt that I have to, keep in mind sometimes, especially when they talk about certain things, like, I don't know, like, who, like, what's your favorite, like, gay movie or something, when it's like I'm, like, not allowed to, like, watch that kind of stuff. It's just very, like, censored in my personal home because of, like, the culture that I grew up in. Like, I asked my mom what if I could see Love, Simon when it came out, and she got, like, mad at me because it's like a gay film, obviously. And so these things that, like, are maybe easier for them to relate to are harder for me to relate to. I haven't experienced, like, I guess direct, you know, like any sort of like difficulties or whatever for my identity yet. I don't know. I still got a lot of college to go. But it's more so just like, it's the like the little things, I would say, that just kind of present themselves in like very specific scenarios like that. But I would say I'm lucky so far to have not experienced like an outrageous attack or anything, because the reality is that like there are outrageous attacks elsewhere, you know, especially after like in the wake of like COVID-19, Asian hate crimes went up so to such a high percentage. And even as recently as like this week, this is actually very personal to me, but a Bangladeshi man who, he was 65, he attended the mosque that my family attends and in Upper Darby, and he was shot outside the mosque. This was on ABC News. It's like Googleable information. But the article does not tell you that his son is also in the hospital. And his daughter was found dead with her body by the Schuylkill River a month ago. And I was talking to my Bangladeshi friend about this, and she was like, wait, his other sister died? And I was like, wait, he had a first sister who died? And it's like, this sort of thing like spreads like very quickly within the Bangladeshi community because of how immigration tends to work out. A lot of us are populated in like the same neighborhood in West Philadelphia. And you know, so everything spreads very quickly within our little circle, but it is a very intentional decision on the part of, you know, big news companies to not air out our stories because they don't really care about us at the end of the day. It's us who kind of are left to fend for ourselves, which is, again, really hard because in a large way, we're kind of made to feel like voiceless and that we don't have an impact because we're just a means to an end in whatever place that we're in, and we're not actual individuals with emotions or opinions. We're submissive, we're this, we're that. And so, like, honestly, like, this, like, news in my community has, like, really, like, taken, like, a toll on me. Like, I was, like crying about this, like 3 days ago, because it is, like, so tough to see this, like, anti-Muslim, like, sort of violence that really, again, stems from unresolved, like, biases that were never, like, even, like, sort of like tackled at all within childhood, and it just keeps on getting worse and worse and worse and escalates and escalates and escalates.
Right, and I feel like there was a reason that the children, the sisters and the brother weren't included in that story, because when you bring children into stories, you bring emotion and you bring empathy and sympathy.
That's a very good point, yeah. The last thing that I wanted to touch on, because I pretty much touched on a lot of the like media, mental health, workplace discrimination. So another big thing is that I based a lot of what I said earlier on this documentary. It's available online if you would like to watch it. It's called But I Look Like a Lawyer. It derives its title. It's like a response title to a book that was written by, a black woman who's a lawyer. And it's called You Don't Look Like a Lawyer, because that's unfortunately what a lot of People that I've read up on have said that they've been told as soon as they've entered the workplace is that they're like literally on the basis of their race alone, they just don't look like they belong there. And that is, again, compounded by things like the food that they eat and the behavior that they're presumed to have. There's stories about hires being worried that they won't be fluent in the court setting despite them having already spoken in an interview just fine for over an hour. Another quote that I wrote down that I thought was interesting was, again, from a person who was hiring, told a East Asian woman, "Family law would be great for you. There's a lot of that in your background. You could be a great crusader for immigrant women." And I think that really shows this aspect that I didn't talk about earlier, where we're kind of like scapegoated in a sense that like we like the way that we represent ourselves in the workforce is that, like I said, a lot of Asian people do represent these really high earning STEM professions and whatnot, but a lot of us, especially like I said earlier, like South Asian people, you know, again, Apu from The Simpsons, a lot of us are, you know, we work at corner stores and we work cabbies, things like that, which are very low wage jobs. And there's this like really big gap. And so there's this idea that, you know, like most Asian people are like going to be super like affluent after enough time. And for the ones who don't, you're going to be representing them and you're going to be putting them in high praises. So it's going to be a net good for us to keep on pushing this narrative. Ultimately, these low-wage workers, small businesses, family-owned businesses like the ones in Chinatown are completely erased by this presumption that we're all some champions of the workforce.
Does that make you angry?
Yes.
That's a good way to end it up. Since we have to wrap it up now. Kavi, thank you so much for a very informative, very honest hour, which I think will be very valuable to people to listen to.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you all so much for coming in and talking about the stereotypes with Asian Americans and the legal profession. It's so important for us to keep talking about these issues to change society's normal and to further inform and educate others about it. Thank you to Kavi for hosting this event. And again, we post our roundtables to our YouTube channel and we are broadcasted on the first and third Sundays of each month from 8 to 9 a.m. on the GTAM Radio 92.5 FM WGGT. Thank you and have a great day.